paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Well, welcome to the radio. This is Rick Hogan doing his best to fill in for Bill and Wendy. I have today, and I'm usually on Sundays, usually on from 9 to 11, but during hawk season, that is sometimes not on from 9 to 11, sometimes on from 10 to 11, as I will be this Sunday. One of my favorite writers and one of my favorite people on the planet, and certainly in Chicago, is Richard Lindberg. He has written, I'm not even going to make a guess, Richard. His latest book is Gangland Chicago, 150 Years of Mayhem in the Street. He is, in my new means of breaking the mold of radio, doing in-depth interviews. He will be on till 11 o'clock. Richard, Happy New Year and all that jazz.
Rick, it's so nice to be back here again with you. It's been a few years.
We've done a few shows, but that's because you write books. It's got to be near 20, yes?
Well, it's inching upward. It's 17 right now.
17.
And, I'm not done yet.
Oh, no, you're never done. You're never done. What always intrigued me, and I think, you know, people who get hooked on history, it happens in different kinds of ways. It may be a great grammar school teacher. It may be an uncle telling you stories. In your case, if memory serves me, it was seeing a movie in the loop, wasn't it?
Well, my interest in the gangland aspect of Chicago and organized crime really started in 1967 when I saw the St. Valentine's Day Massacre at the Roosevelt Theater.
Remember the Roosevelt, ladies and gentlemen?
I will never forget. There was a restaurant next door to it, and I was just starting high school at the time, and I went in there, and they had these two Thompson submachine guns on display above the bar. And I was oohing and aahing. And then I saw the movie, and then that afternoon I took the bus northward to Clark Street bus. And saw the building 2 months before it was torn down.
The building where the St. Valentine's Day Massacre took place.
Scraping the dirt on the window, looking in there.
Well, was it S&M Cartage?
SMC Cartage Company.
Yeah.
And then the interesting thing at the end of the life of that building was that it was an antique store. An elderly couple had bought it in 1949, and they eventually got fed up with the number of people walking in off the street that wanted to see
the wall. Where the bullet hole?
Yeah, and they're trying to sell antiques, and they just wanted to see the wall, and it got taken apart brick by brick. And the bricks were then purchased by a guy who owned a discotheque in Vancouver.
A Canadian guy. That's right.
Yeah, and he built it into the wall behind the urinals in the men's room, so that you get the idea.
Well, yes, of course. What's happened? I remember writing about that guy. I can't remember his name, but then some other people tried to auction off the bricks.
Well, there's been a legend that's arisen that the bricks are cursed. I guess, as I understand it, he eventually had some financial problems with the restaurant bar.
Well, anybody dumb enough to say, hey, I'm going to buy the St. Valentine's Day Massacre wall and put it up in my restaurant could have problems.
Well, it was a great gimmick, but I think the bricks were disassembled. Some were put on eBay. I believe there's a collector in Chicago who had acquired them and put them in his garage. I'm sure that they're scattered to the winds, but at least one person has a substantial collection of them.
You got hooked, and I'm so glad you're going to be here for an hour because we can go all through Chicago history and crime and sports. You're a huge White Sox fan. Mm. And then later on, concentrate on Gangland Chicago, 150 years of mayhem in the streets, which I think is so timely and topical. But what the hell is it, do you think, Richard Lindberg, about Al Capone that continue? He's still on the level of Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey and, God love him, Rahm Emanuel, as a Chicago figure. What is it? It hooked you, the whole St. Valentine's Day Massacre movie. But what is it about Capone?
Well, it hooked me initially, but now I'm tired of him.
Thank God!
You know, honestly, it has become such media overkill. And there is just such a cottage industry in books about the Capone period, cable documentaries, the crime shows. And what it does is it really creates a false impression of Chicago. Al Capone was only here 12 years of his life.
And he wasn't from here.
No, he was from Brooklyn. And I think that there's been a false mystique that's been attached to him. The fact that he opened up a soup kitchen during the Depression on South State Street, that's a nice thing, but it was just a public relations
Sure.
Talk. There's other people out there now who want to recraft the image of Capone into the good Capone. This man was a murderer. He was a pimp. He was a thief.
Yeah.
He had something. He had a cachet about him, and he was really the first gangster to organize a mob along corporate lines with a chain of command mm-hmm. and business-like structures. And his boss is wearing three-piece suits and sitting in boardrooms, and that he kind of invented the whole genre, which was later copied in the 1930s as the Five Families of New York formed.
And he was also relatively a public figure. He was not loathe. Actually, he loved talking to reporters. That's part of it, too. The media is a big player in this Capone mystique.
It's the same thing with John Gotti in New York.
Yep.
The more public the person, the more gregarious the individual, they're going to get headlines.
Yeah.
And Capone recognized early on the publicity value. But again, it goes back to the point that I made earlier. His reign in Chicago was so short. I mean, technically 12 years, but really 6 years, from 1925 to 1931. Because prior to 1925, Johnny Torrio and his predecessors ran the mob.
Yeah.
So Capone had a very short shelf life in Chicago, but it coincided with some of the most violent years in crime history. 1926 became the apex of mob murder in the city of Chicago. But in a way, that figure is dwarfed by what's going on today.
Yeah, one of the things, and we're going to be all over the map because I'm so happy Richard Lindbergh can. You can explore more of Richard Lindbergh when you get a chance later this afternoon or sometime at richardlindbergh.net. You can see the many, nearly 20 books that he has written. The Glorification, the movie you saw. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre with Jason Robards, a good, compelling actor, playing Al Capone.
And that chew the rug. Yes.
Yeah, look who's played him. You got Robert De Niro. You got Rod Steiger. And I'm just, this is off the top of my head, who played Capone and put him into this. They made him for a killer. It's the same thing, Richard Lindbergh, that happened to Tony Soprano. Tony Soprano, fictional character, became this kind of beloved, you feel sorry because he has to go see a psychiatrist to get rid of his problems. There's something lovable about these guys, but there shouldn't be, should there?
No, there shouldn't. But the public lives vicariously through these characters. They see in the TV portrayals and in Hollywood a glamorization of criminal life. I think that really unfolded substantially with the release of The Godfather in 1972.
Yeah.
Crime earlier had never been glorified. Under the Hays Code in 1931, the malefactors always were punished or ended up in prison or were dead by the end of the movie. But I've argued in the book that popular culture has a lot to do with the promotion of crime, because even in the early films, the Roaring Twenties with Jimmy Cagney,
sure.
Public Enemy and so forth, disenfranchised youth in the street would watch these movies. And even for a short time, the criminal is flashing money and big cars and nightclubs. But even if he gets punished in the end, the fact is that he's showing this behavior early on, and he has the semblance of success, which they emulate. And I believe very strongly that the portrayal in Hollywood and in the pulp dime novels of the day helped create a criminal class in the streets.
Oh, interesting.
That saw no way out.
Yeah, but that is what that's why I'm saying Gangland Chicago, 150 Years of Mayhem in the Streets, Richard Lindbergh's most recent book, is unbelievably topical. We're going to talk about that right after a break. Then we'll talk about his beloved White Sox, and then what I consider his most profound work, a work of incredible honesty and one that's very, very personal, called, and here's a chilling title for you, Whiskey Breakfast. We'll be back in a couple seconds. My guest for this entire hour is Richard Lindbergh, the distinguished and prolific author of Chicago history books. Go to his website. His website's wonderful. Richard Lindberg, LINDBERG.net. You'll also read some very nice things he has to say about my father and Mike Royko, and talk about the various influences on your career. This whole gangland thing, your latest book, and I don't want to concentrate on this because you have so many other things to talk about. We hit on it in the last segment, Gangland Chicago, 150 Years of Mayhem in the Streets. It covers gangs from the earliest gangs to contemporary gangs. And this is a, what's the origin of gangs, I've often thought in my nickel and dime philosophy, is it gives young people, there's a sense of family in a gang, isn't there, Richard?
Well, there's an important sense of social identity, peer acceptance, which at a young age is really front and center of a person's life. And if they can't achieve it legitimately, they find it in the streets. It's a byproduct of poverty, despair, homelessness. It's not a new phenomenon.
That is the thing about your book. It just resonates and echoes in contemporary life.
The conditions of 1900 are markedly similar to what we're seeing today. Did you realize, Rick, that in 1900 we had absolutely no gun control in Chicago, none whatsoever? Mm. You could go into a hardware store, and really all you had to do was present yourself and appear to be over the age of consent, and you could buy a handgun without even writing down your name, without anybody asking you for what purpose you're going to use it for. There was a plaintive hue and cry to impose some kind of gun control in 1900.
Wow.
And here we are, 115 years later,
still fighting,
wrestling with this issue. The gangs of the post-Civil War period up before Capone operated along the same lines as today. They fought for turf. They fought for neighborhood control. Narcotics was never a part of the equation in those days.
Right,
But
gambling, prostitution.
On a street level, it was armed robbery, home invasions. Home invasion was one of the most prolific, serious crimes committed in Chicago. It was mostly in the poor working areas of Maxwell Street, up in Little Hell, as it was called, which we
over
know as Cabrini
North,
Green.
Yeah, near North Side.
And in various parts of the South Side. People were accosted on the streets. Handbag snatching from women was very common. Thuggery was reigning. And the one differentiator, though, in those days was you had the political gangs. You had organized gangs which were sanctioned by local politicians, ward healers, aldermen, who in return for services at Election Day, in other words, intimidating opposition voters, would be rewarded with jobs as bailiffs in the court system or working in the sheriff's department or wherever. So it was a give and take, and it was kind of a parasitic relation.
So being in a gang, in a sense, in those days, could lead to some kind of career outside of crime, well, to sort of loosely outside of crime.
And each of the major sections of the city were dominated by certain gangs. For example, on the near north side was the Market Street Gang. That was the 23rd Ward. State Senator John O'Malley relied on the Market Street Gang to win his elections. And you know, it's interesting, Rick, because in those days at polling places, they had troughs to water the horses. And let's say you went in there and you voted incorrectly. You would get a dunking in the water trough. I mean, that's how
politics think politics is crazy now. Wow.
Yeah. It was, and on the South Side, you had what they call the social athletic clubs. And it wasn't just Reagan's Colts and a few others. You had maybe 120, 130, and there were social athletic clubs on the North Side. Ostensibly, they were sports clubs.
Right.
They organized into city leagues. They received coverage from the sports sections of the newspapers. But underneath that, there was a level of criminal activity. Many of the Reagan's Colts, the most dominant gang of the South Side, evolved into bootleggers and joined the Capone mob in the 1920s. Frank Reagan had to eliminate and call the whole thing off in 1927 simply because his followers had all matriculated.
Richard, you make a case, I think, in the book that in some ways prohibition kind of raised the level of gang sophistication, and gangs realizing that, wow, there may be more money in this whole gang thing, organized crime thing, than there is in Mrs. Jones's purse. Yeah.
The great American disaster, if you will, I think, was Prohibition.
Yeah.
But it did have it was grounded in idealism and the belief that if you cure alcoholism, you'll cure a myriad of social problems.
Mm-hmm.
It began with the best of intentions, but had failed so spectacularly. The gangs before 1920 were guys who wore scruffy-looking clothes, and they were safecrackers, and they were burglars, and they were hijackers, and there were little pockets of them all around the city. But what happened after 1920, after the gang wars had been completed and Capone emerged the victor, you had organizational charts, and it was patterned after big business.
Yeah.
You had captains, you had
lieutenants,
and bosses and soldiers and so on, and it was a military big business type chain of command. And this was the consequence of Prohibition, not only in Chicago, but in 26 major American cities where Prohibition gangs became the modern mob.
It is so interesting always to talk to Richard Lindbergh. It is an equal delight to read him. We're concentrating sort of now on his most recent book, Gangland Chicago, 150 Years of Mayhem in the Streets. We'll do a little more of that after the news because I want to get his take on contemporary gangs. And he and I have both lived through a real change in the nature of gangs because of the influence of drugs. So please stay tuned. We'll get a commercial, then we'll get some news, and we'll continue on with Richard Lindbergh. Welcome back. Rick Hogan filling in for Bill and Wendy, and wishing you all a Happy New Year and a Merry Christmas. I know that's a little late for that. My guest for the next 25 minutes and for the previous 35 minutes is Richard Lindbergh, a prolific, smart Chicago writer, historian. You are a historian, Richard, but if the choice came between historian and writer, what would you call yourself? That's a tough one, I know. Occurred to me.
I always go historian slash writer and sometimes writer slash historian. But I guess I'm a writer. I've been writing since I was 11 years old.
Yeah.
I started keeping a journal, something boys in that age never did.
That's true.
A secret journal, and I've maintained it all my life. What really inspired me as a kid, with not a whole lot of resources or a whole lot of friends, I began reading books in library. And I'm going to confess this. I was very fond of those old Classics Illustrated comic books.
I know. Your website is great. You really get to know. I hope you get to know a lot about him here, but you'll learn how he started reading, what his favorite authors are, how he came late to John O'Hara.
I discovered John O'Hara when everybody else was done with him.
Yeah. Well, they were done with him for a long time.
Yeah.
I'll never forget in the early 60s when my father was running a thing called Panorama at the Chicago Daily News and Arts and Entertainment section. O'Hara was a god of his, and he asked O'Hara to write a weekly column, and it was the most bizarre, reactionary thing. It was one of my father's worst moments when he had to tell John O'Hara we couldn't run the column anymore. But O'Hara's a great writer, as is Richard Lindbergh. You did not have a pleasant childhood. You once told me that going to grammar school, I don't hate to bring this up, but it's relevant, going to grammar school in Norwood Park was, quote, 8 years of ceaseless torment, abuse, and nervous anxiety.
It's it definitely shaped my future life. I began studying the whole issue of bullies and the impact that they have upon children, and it's really quite profound. The residual effects of it last well into middle. You know, it's interesting because Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts,
sure,
was bullied as a kid.
Yep.
And on his deathbed, when he was about to expire, he was still talking about those kids that had picked on him in grammar school. It's something that doesn't go away. And it was often such an ignored problem of childhood.
Oh, no question. When we were growing up, I absolutely ignored.
You know, I've often thought myself about starting a support group or a self-help group for victims of it.
Mm.
Because sometimes when you're in your 20s and 30s, you're in denial. Oh, that didn't happen to me. That happened to somebody else.
Well, sure, you're trying to move on. You're trying to forget it. It's like something you're shedding.
But then you get to a point where it all comes back. Usually in the 40s, you start reflecting on your life. Because I think in the 40s, people tend to start looking back on where they have been and where they have gone. And it comes back. But I must say this, though. I could not have been a writer without it. Because writing is such an internal pursuit. It's solitary. It's kind of solitary work you do. And it just opened up a world to me of books and writers and adventure stories and taking me to places that I had never imagined possible living in the northwest side of Chicago.
Well, and your dad, who had you when he was 56 years old, presented another set of problems, detailed, I think, brilliantly in Richard's book from about 2011 titled Whiskey Breakfast. It's a memoir, but it's also a sweeping kind of story of a Swedish-American family and covering three generations. It's divorce, disillusionment. That had to be a rough book for you to write, but a cleansing kind of thing, yes?
Yes, it was 22 years from idea and inspiration to publication. I had the title of it in 1989, 3 years after my father died, and it refers to my father's habit of having a VO Manhattan at 11:45 in the morning.
Wow.
Hence Whiskey Breakfast.
Yeah.
And it was a bearing of the soul, a bearing of my life, and it was hard, but I was determined to see it through. And finally it happened in 2011.
Well, but the thing, too, and you must have, post-publication of that book in 2011, you must have heard from a vast number of people, whether they're Greek-American, African-American, Jewish-American, saying, oh, my God, that was my family.
I had an outpouring of response, and this is remarkable given the fact that it was published by a university press.
Right.
In Minnesota. But the stories they were sharing, and it was not only the stories of their immigration experience, but kids that had the bully problem, too, were contacting me. And you know, I think I realized that I had made a breakthrough in my career, and I thought to myself, this is the real kind of writing I want to do in the future. And then, lo and behold, I'm back writing.
You think it was difficult to shed the bully part of your life, the history. It's not an obsession, but and I do it too a lot, Richard. You kind of, and a lot of people do. You kind of, there's nothing wrong to my mind with living partly in the past.
Well, as a historian, I live in the past.
Yeah.
I have hopes. I have one project in front of me right now. I'm doing an institutional history of my alma mater, Northeastern Illinois University. And when I complete that, I'm going to attempt to do a novel. And I'm going to attempt to do a novel on time travel in Chicago back to that famous era of the 1900s and 1890s.
Which no one would be able to do it any better than you, I'm telling you.
I've got the anecdotes and the stories, but crafting fiction takes me into a whole different world. I'm a nonfiction writer.
Yeah.
And novelists say they can't write nonfiction and vice versa.
Sure.
I mean, you yourself, I mean...
I've had trouble with novels, too. Thank you very much, yeah.
It's really a complete crossover into something totally different, but I'm going to give it a shot, at least.
Hey, how did you got contact commissioned to write the history of your alma mater?
Yes. When I was in completing high school, I never thought I'd have a chance to go to college. My father, who had the financial means to help me with college, declined to do it.
Oh, that's nice.
My stepmother suggested that I go to junior college, and then if I could get through 2 years of junior college, then they might consider it. Well, he wanted me to go to North Park because of its Swedish heritage, but I couldn't afford that. So I worked myself through Northeastern, and they gave me a fabulous opportunity. Northeastern is a commuter school. Was there to serve first-generation college students.
Yeah.
And everybody who went there, they will often say they were the first one in their family to go to college. So I'm doing this as kind of a payback to them for giving me the chance to go to college.
But there also must be some great stories. I mean, some really great stories of, you know, the same thing happened a lot, when Circle finally built that horrifying campus
and
moved from Navy Pier. I ran into a lot of kids, too, there who were the sense of pride in being the first in their family, and the sense of ambition was palpable.
It's a great accomplishment, and especially to a lot of us who grew up in households where the parents were ambivalent about education.
Yeah.
A lot of blue-collar families, and my mother used to say when I was in college, oh, you know, you think you're so smart because you're going to college. Well, I went to the College of Hard Knocks.
Right.
And
right.
I heard that continuously, you know. And you think, and you know, live a few years, and that's where you'll get your real college education. That uh-huh. You know, that attitude was very prevalent in a lot of blue-collar families.
No question. Yeah. No question, because many blue-collar families were second, first-generation Americans themselves.
And they resented in some ways the success that their children had going to college because they themselves could not do it.
We'll take a little break and then come back and finish off this terrific hour with Richard Lindbergh. You can sometime today or while you're on a lot of people on vacation this week, go to Richard Lindbergh, LindBerg.net to see order his many books and learn a little more about him than even we can do in an entire hour of radio, one of these rare in-depth interviews. But I certainly hope you are getting to know Richard. You're not going to know him as well as I do because I've read all of his books, but I hope you get to know him a little. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Me, Rick Kogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy, and having spent 45-some minutes with Richard Lindbergh, I am now again imbued with passion for Chicago history, as he has been and as it's manifested itself in nearly 20 books about that history. You can get a really good look and order books at richardlindbergh.net. Richard, you and I both appreciate and love and write about history, and I worry these days that in this Twitter, fast-paced, icy communication age, that people do not appreciate. My belief is that history, of course, is everywhere, that it echoes everywhere. But if we're plugged into iPhones all the time, we can't hear it. And it is crucially important, as your latest book, Gangland Chicago, 150 Years of Mayhem in the Streets, will tell people, it. If you don't know it, you don't really know where you are or where you might be going.
Well, I think part of the fault lies with the cutback in history studies in our schools.
Good point.
It's not being taught anymore. Kids aren't learning about music or any of the softer side of living.
And the creative side of living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And sadly, young people, their history only extends back as far as what they can remember personally. I remember Milt Rosenberg would often say how shocked he was that people could not find the capital of Germany on a map if they looked at students at the college level. We are losing our culture. We talked earlier about books, you and I, and how there's no coverage of books anywhere.
Yeah.
And bookstores are closing. The world has changed in profound ways since you and I were first coming up.
No question.
And it's not for the best. I have worries about the future of the printed word in our world.
The other thing I think all people need to do is be introduced to that history in a compelling way, which you have spent your entire adult life doing. You know, you look at a success of something like Devil in the White City, which we both should have written. One or both of us should
have written. Well, I pitched it in the 80s, and they said nobody would be interested in a local Chicago story like that.
Well, I hope that publisher's banging their head against the wall now. But when it's just a matter, and you're right, it's a matter of introducing people to the history. As lively and crazy and chaotic and wild as Chicago is today, it was wilder, more chaotic, and crazy in the past.
It was wild, chaotic, and crazy, but in some ways, Rick, I think that generation had a lot more fun.
Oh.
I think that everything was a living spectacle. They were certainly less politically correct times than we live in
That's
today.
That's a fact.
And people were uninhibited in what they would say and what they would do. Outrageous behavior was kind of given a wink and a nod. I'm not saying we should go back to that, but there was a certain kind of panache, I think, to the era. the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and it all kind of began to disappear, I think, in the 60s and in the 70s.
It probably ended when Riverview closed in 67.
Exactly.
That's funny.
And, you know, I've always said that air conditioning and television have caused us to turn inward, and the computer was the final nail in the coffin. I mean, in the old days, people would come home from work, they'd get dressed up, and they would go out again to socialize. You had nightclubs in every neighborhood in Chicago.
Yeah.
You had the city was jumping all night long.
Or also, at another point, if you didn't have money and the means to go out nightclubbing, you could sit on your front steps. You could sit on your back porch. You could communicate in ways, sort of the fabric of the city is frayed, and I think that's... To get back for a few minutes to your spectacular book, Gangland, Chicago, 150 Years of Mayhem in the Streets, that's one of the reasons there is mayhem in the streets, is there the community's fractured.
There are isolated, fractured communities that have lost their commercial districts, their industrial base. It's a war zone. The middle class has long since departed. Corporate America has to reinvest in these neighborhoods. Without grocery stores in communities in Chicago, how are people going to eat? The only economy that's left to them is the criminal economy and drug distribution. Families are broken up. One of the points I make in the book is that after 1960, the divorce rate in this country begins to soar.
Mm.
And in many respects, that contributed to the rise in juvenile delinquency. But of course, juvenile delinquency really kind of begins to escalate in the early 1950s, and it coincides with the rise of rock and roll and Marlon Brando's movie The Wild One.
Wild One.
Yeah.
The nature, in the few minutes, you've written a lot about policemen over the years. We're at an incredible crisis point here where the mayor is, you know, going to attempt to alter a culture, and was not a policeman. I know his uncle was or something. But are you certainly troubled by what's happening out here when two people are shot and killed, one by admitted accident? Are you hopeful at all about...
Well, the Chicago Police Department has undergone many periodic spasms of scandal, mm-hmm. crisis, and reform. Prior to 1960, major police scandals, be it corruption arrangements or brutality, which was quite common, would occur on two-year cycles. There would be a reform group that would be appointed to examine a blue ribbon panel. They would submit their findings. A few captains would be transferred around to different districts, and then it would quiet down.
Right.
Then another 2 years. It was like the current off of Lake Michigan mm-hmm. rolling up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the federal investigation is long overdue. This isn't the first time we've had outside sources coming in.
No.
In 1904, Alexander Piper
did
a searching investigation of the Chicago Police Department, and that led to numerous reforms. He pointed to the patronage. He pointed to the bribery, men who were physically unfit to do the rigorous task.
1904, yeah.
And it led to major reforms. So and the department did get better,
mm-hmm.
but... Like most police departments, there's a relapse period, because if the vigilance isn't there after the investigation, the dust settles and things go back to the way they were. I think this is a very pivotal point in police history. I have to be confident that that some good will come out of this.
Sure.
But, of course, you're dealing with a secret Oath Brown Brotherhood, and it's impossible to separate the belief that police officers have that nobody cares about them except themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of creates an us-against-them mentality.
And part of it is societal, too. When you have, and you get around this city enough to know this, neighborhoods that are shamefully, shamefully beaten up, where there is no opportunity, where there is no... How are you supposed to trust anybody?
Well, yes, exactly. And the police are viewed with suspicion. The community, understandably, is afraid to reveal secrets or identify felons that are out there for fear of reprisal. None of this is new. This has been a feature of urban living, of slum living for decades in this city.
Yeah.
I'm not optimistic that this problem will ever go away, to be honest with you.
Well, but you give it the kind of perspective that's needed to be given because you understand the history of this city. And just in the 5 minutes you've been talking about the police department, you get a sense of knowing that history is important to moving forward. There's no question about it. Richard, I cannot wait for your novel. I cannot wait for your novel.
I can't either.
Yeah, I know. Well, and you listening public and reading public out there, it's a great thing to see you. This new book, Gangland Chicago, 150 Years of Mayhem in the Streets, is not only an important lesson to where we were, but it really echoes where we are. So congratulations on that. Keep writing.
Thank you, Rick, and you too.
Hey.
We need to see a new Kogan book come out.
Well, one of these days. I'm just hanging on by my fingernails to the newspaper business. Richard Lindberg, LINDBERG.net. Enjoy that. Happy New Year to those of you listening. Stay tuned for Emily Rush, a junior at St. Mary's of Notre Dame, coming in here to give me insight into the youth of America. Then we'll get a bunch of songs that I hope will put you in the good mood. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Well, thanks, Kim Gordon. This is Rick Kogan finishing up his fill-in stint for Bill and Wendy. And yesterday and today, my friend Emily Rush has been in the studio observing how the show goes because she's a junior at St. Mary's of Notre Dame. And now, this must tell you, Emily, if nothing else, it's like, hey, anybody can be a radio host.
No, right? Yeah, everyone here definitely makes it look so easy. Yeah.
Well, you're working with Kevin Richter, who's producing, yeah. And Ben Cortez, a longtime engineer here. Emily, you grew up in Mokena.
Yes.
You went to Lincoln Way.
East,
yeah. West, Southeast. How many are there?
There's we're down to three now. We used to have four, but that's a long story for another day. But yeah, I went to Lincoln Way East.
When did you start thinking about college?
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, when you're a kid, college is, you know, it seems years and years away. And,
yeah.
You know, and of course, you know, you get through high school and you're in your second half and, you know, it's really starting to hit you with reality. I was never really nervous by it. I always, you know, kind of had an idea of where I wanted to go. And, you know, I think definitely at me, just like most other kids, you know, by junior year, you really start to kind of.
Do you in junior year, I know some kids, most of them are younger than you. Mm-hmm. You're now 21. Do you, when you decide to pick a college, mm-hmm. are you also thinking about a career or, you know what I mean?
It's
You know, I don't know many 17-year-olds, some who say, well, I want to be, I know a lot of dumb 17-year-olds who go, hey, I want to be an investment banker, which isn't a job to me. But are you toying with possible careers at that age, too? And does that come into play when you decide where to go?
I think so. I think definitely. You know, when you go to visit colleges, they'll always say, oh, you know, certain colleges are known for certain things.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this college has a great engineering program, and this college has a great nursing program. And so, you know, you're really kind of getting your wheels turning, you know. If you want to be like an engineer or a nurse, you know, you probably know that at a very early stage, and then you can kind of gauge your thing there. For me, I didn't really have a career in mind that I wanted to track, and even still, you know, I'm very open. But I think what it all kind of comes down to is you really just have to picture yourself somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty much for the first time in your life that you get to choose where you want to spend your next 4 years. You know, not just your education, but also where you're living and, you know, things you're going to do.
Good point.
So, and, you know, college visits can be very intimidating because you're trying to picture all those things. And
when you go on these college visits, mm-hmm. and I suppose you don't like sneak in with your mom,
hop
Colleen,
the fence,
or dad, Jeff. That it's kind of like they give you a sales pitch. It's like, oh, hi, Emily, you'd love it here.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you meet all our cute boys we have here? You know what I mean? Like they do with athletes or something.
You know, there's definitely a bit of a sales pitch to it, which can be pretty intimidating because, you know, you visit any campus and they're going to show you the greatest parts of it.
Sure.
And they're going to, you know, explain to you all the great things. And they don't really, you know, they don't really give you kind of the ins and outs of like the everyday, which is, again, something you just kind of have to experience for yourself. But I didn't even really go on a lot of toured college visits. Later on, when I kind of realized like the serious schools I wanted to go to, I then looked deeper into them. But
Did you kind of have your heart set on St. Mary's?
I really did kind of going into it. But I even told like my brother and like other people who were, you know, going and looking at schools, like you'll get a feel for it just by driving around. Like if you just get in your car and just drive around or walk around by yourself, I was able to eliminate a lot of schools that way just by kind of walking around. But no, I did. I really did always kind of have my heart set.
You know, just your mentioning this, Emily Rush, it is a huge, to my mind, commitment. You were committing yourself to 4 years in a different place. Was it at all, when you made the decision about St. Mary's, was it at all, was there a period of adjustment those first few months? Was it difficult on any level?
It definitely was. It was, I went from, you know, it's just my brother and I, but we both have our own separate bedrooms. So it went from, you know, living alone to now living with two other people who are on two different sleep schedules, on two different, you know,
class schedules. Yeah,
I mean, yeah, you know, and people, it's just, that's kind of another angle that you kind of have to get used to, is now living with people as well.
And I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, and living, you know, and we were in dorms, so it was right one on top of another, basically. So, yeah, it's definitely interesting. It's very exciting, and, you know, It's part of the whole experience, for sure.
One of the interesting things, and I'm one of the big readers, I'm probably the only reader of Becoming Bells who's not a relative of one of the Bells. There is a website, right?
Yes.
It's called becomingbells.com,
yeah,
I think.
It's becomingbells.tumblr.com. It's a Tumblr account.
And those, this is a kind of ongoing diary of, you started this when you were a freshman. You started doing this as a freshman. Mm-hmm. What is it exactly?
It's a blogging site, and I work for the admissions office at St. Mary's of Notre Dame, and we basically work with, you know, it's myself and a few other writers, and we just upload kind of weekly blogs about what's going on. And, you know, I think if I had known about it before I, you know, actually was enrolled, I think it would have been great, because it's unfiltered. It's all about, you know, the girls and their daily lives of what's really going on, and, you know, issues and things that are on campus and we're all kind of going through. And, you know, when I was able to study abroad in Europe for a semester, I got to take
that
with me.
We'll talk about that after the news. We can tell you a little bit about Ireland. Yeah. But I find it incredibly insightful. I mean, do you recommend to, I don't know if you talk to seniors or juniors in high school now who might be thinking of going to St. Mary's in Notre Dame, that this, I have found it unbelievable. It's very upbeat, generally. It's
for
not,
sure.
People aren't talking about being depressed or failing classes. It's a very upbeat kind of blog, but it really does give you insight into freshman, sophomore, and junior lives.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing, too, especially, you know, today's day and age, you know, especially millennials my age, you know, we have so much access to social media. And, you know, usually colleges nowadays are really banking on that as a way to kind of hook kids in, you know, to create social media accounts, whether it be a blogging account or Instagram or Facebook. And you can kind of, you know, tweet out or you know, post up messages. And, you know, as a student who's in high school looking to go into college, you know, that's a really good tool to have. And it's a great way to reach out.
Yeah, because as you say, it's an unfiltered kind of site. I've learned a lot about kids, meaning you too, on reading Becoming Bells. It's like something I check out every week to make sure, well, you'll write about this. Oh, I met these two guys, Kevin Richter and Ben Cortez. And it was really fun on the radio. I'm talking this whole half hour to Emily Rush from South Suburban Mokena. She is the elder sister of Trevor and the daughter of Colleen and Jeff. Back for a few minutes with Emily Rush. You, Emily, who grew up in Mokena and go to St. Mary's of Notre Dame, even though South Bend is a big city, Mokena is not. You, over the years, over your teenage, you have really fallen in love with the city itself, the city of Chicago. How come? Besides it being really active and fun and you can do a million things.
You know, I think going back to when you had Richard on earlier, you know, just the history of this city, you know, and they call it, you know, second city. To me, it's second to none. I mean, I really think that, you know, it's, I think the people here are truly what make it, and the history between, you know, the police force and firefighters and, you know, just everyone that kind of brings this city together. Me personally, you know, and I've grown up in the Midwest my whole life, sure. So I can't really preach too much on it. But, you know, friends that I've met, you know, through college who are from the East Coast and the West Coast,
of course,
they always say the same thing. You know, people from the Midwest are so friendly. And, you know, when you throw that into a city landscape, you know, I think it's really great. And, you know, to have kind of also a even scale wise, you know, we're a little smaller, you know, compared to a city such as New York and
or Los Angeles
or Los Angeles, exactly.
Crazy place like that. I mean, you can get around here. Your house sitting up, you know, in the Newtown neighborhood for your aunt and uncle and two cousins, nieces. Mm-hmm. What are those girls?
Cousins to me,
okay.
Yeah.
And their dog,
yeah.
Crosby. and you get around as if you're, you know, 25 years old instead of just 21. You got the chance, and this happens at many universities, I've learned, mm-hmm. to do some foreign study.
Yes, yeah.
It was Ireland. Your heritage.
Yes.
What was that like for you?
To me, that was truly just the most eye-opening experience. That was something, you know, to spend a semester in a completely different country, different culture, different time zone, different everything. And, you know, to get to travel to other countries while you're there, too. To me, I learned more in those in that one semester than I could in any classroom.
Well, kind of makes you grow up faster to be in
absolutely.
A different culture, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and for me, I had never really traveled anywhere alone, you know, and to fly to another country then with, you know, sure, I had the security blanket of a lot of the girls that I went to school with. But, you know, we were all kind of wide-eyed and in the same boat together, you know, just kind of, okay, we want to go to Rome for 3 days. Let's learn how to navigate that. And then you can grow up very quickly in those 3 days of, you know, traveling to other places.
I think that's great. Now, what are your thoughts? Now, in the same way that you were a junior at Lincoln Way and thinking about colleges, mm-hmm. now, is this the time in college where you start thinking about a career?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's
or do you
scary.
Just tell your parents, hey, I want to go to graduate school.
Yeah,
I don't want to leave. I don't want to leave.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, you know, nowadays, you know, it's usually, like I said, that junior year that you really kind of have to make the next step and, you know, really kind of figure out what you want to do. And, you know, unfortunately,
what's your major?
I'm an English major. Yeah.
With a minor in?
Right now, a minor in secondary education.
Okay. So you're thinking of becoming a teacher?
Yeah, but I mean, I've spent a couple days here at the radio show. So, I mean, who knows?
Yes, I can be. Yeah. So now I have these new opportunities. I think the easiest job is being a host.
Yeah.
I think the two hard jobs are being a producer like Kevin Richter or an engineer like Ben Cortez. So you've changed if you want to be
well,
a radio.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing, though. Like, you're always exposed to different things and new ideas. And, you know, unfortunately, I also have friends, too, who, you know, they're doing certain things for the money. And, you know, that's typical. You know,
yeah.
I've got very close friends who are, you know, hate math and science, but they're becoming engineers. I have, again, same thing with, like, anything else. And so, you know, for me, I see that, and it really, honestly, like, it really breaks my heart. Because I know that, sure, you know, that'll get them their temporary happiness right now. It might
get
them
a
little
car.
Bit of job security. Exactly. But what happens, you know, 10, 20 years down the road? And, you know, when you can't get up and go to work every day, you know, you just don't, you're so tired of it. And I learned, you know, being in Ireland, if you ever get the chance to go, you know, it's, the people there are not rich by any means. You realize just how sort of, you know, capitalistic this economy is and consumer,
sure.
you know, how much consumerism there is. And, you know, you go to a country such as, you know, Ireland or even Greece now, who the people there really don't have a whole lot, but they are some of the happiest people that I have ever been around.
Well, that is a great thing to learn
yeah.
in going to college,
mm-hmm.
that being happy may indeed. Because I thought, you know, most kids are like, well, it'd be easy. I want to be an investment banker so I can grow up to be Ken Griffin or, God help you, Bruce Rauner.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great thing.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts? I'm not trying to pin you down.
No, no. You know, to me, like, I've always kind of repeated the same motto. You have one life to live.
That is
that one of the songs?
That is unbelievable.
Okay,
that is
well,
how
I swear I didn't get it from
show.
That.
I know you didn't. That's
no.
how we're ending the show today.
But, you know, you have one life to live. And, you know, if you're me, I was fortunate enough to get some great opportunities, you know, up until now. And, you know, getting accepted into a great school through all my hard work. And then, keeping up that hard work to then get the acceptance to go abroad. And, you know, all the experience kind of piled up and really helped me learn that, you know, you have to do things for you.
Well, that's a really great, that's a great lesson. I mean, I know and love your parents, Colleen and Jeff Rush. Yeah, maybe, and even your brother Trevor, he's a couple of years younger.
Yeah.
He seems to have adjusted incredibly well to college life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very proud of him for that. You know, I didn't really, growing up, I think we both had our own social circles, and you know, as of course you normally do, but you know, you never know how people are going to adjust to a whole new environment. So no, I'm very proud of him for being able to do that, for sure.
Yeah, because I know a lot of some people, not a lot, but some people who go to college and freak out. It's too big a shock for them.
Yeah.
And they come back and they need to be at home.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing for New Year's Eve? Don't say. She's 21 years old. She's got a place in the city.
I'm going to be having fun, I'll tell you that. That's the only thing I plan on doing. Yeah.
And you're staying. One of the great things is the way in this world works is you're staying at a place that's relatively close to Stan's Donuts.
There you go.
Which is owned by this guy, Rich Labriola, who was on yesterday. What do you think of these three guests? Father Cusick, Rich Labriola, and Richard Lindbergh.
Absolutely. I thought they were great. You know, Rich, for me, Labriola, definitely that story, obviously incredible, you know, starting from nothing and then making, obviously, a huge something for himself.
Yeah.
You know, and I had told you yesterday, you know, I had gone and, like, after the show and stopped and grabbed some donuts, and it's a beautiful place.
You know, and it's... It really is Labriola Cafe, which is right on Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, it's a great place, and, you know, good for him, you know, to see something like that.
That gives
you
a lot of hope, too, man.
Yeah.
A guy who fell in love with a piece of bread, basically, said, where do you get this bread? Found out where people got it, went and bought some, put it in the trunk of his car, started selling it, and 20 years later sells the business for $35 million.
Yeah. And if you told a kid my age that today, they wouldn't believe it.
No. Or they'd go out and eat, like, way too much bread.
Yeah.
Emily Rush, it's not my place to be proud of you, but I adore you, and I'm proud of you,
man.
And you are really...
Thank you for having me.
What a 21-year-old should be. So be nice to Crosby and don't put him in a drawer or something on New Year's Eve. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and
the family. We'll take a little break, get some news, and then I'm going to play you a bunch of music. Welcome back. This is me, Rick Cogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy for the next 25 minutes and trying to say Happy New Year to you in song and poetry. At the end of every year, I think it's important to sort of take note of the people who have left the planet. Everybody dies, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody dies, but it's important to remember. This is a song that I often play as a means of remembering. It is Ella Fitzgerald singing Stairway to the Stars.
Let's build a stairway to the stars and climb that stairway to the stars with love beside us. To fill the night with the song, we'll hear the sound of violins out yonder where the blue begins. The moon will guide us as we go drifting along. Can't we still daisy pedal over the rim of the hill? Can't we sail away on a little dream and settle high on the crest of a thrill? Let's build a stairway to the stars, a lovely, lovely stairway to the stars. It would be heaven to climb to heaven with you. Stairway to the stars, sound of violins, way out yonder. he pedal over the rim of the hill. Can we sail away on a little dream and settle high on the crest of a thrill? He builds a stairway to the stars, a lovely stairway to the stars. It wouldn't be heaven.
That was Ella Fitzgerald as a means to say goodbye to people who have left us this year. Now we get upbeat. I want you to listen closely to the words of this poem. It's a very, very empowering poem. It should be one of the 1, 2, 3, 4 steps to lead you into 2016. This is Mary Oliver reading her own poem, which is titled The Summer Day.
The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Now, that is a good question to try to answer before you go into 2016. What do you plan to do with your wild and precious life? That's a very short poem by Mary Oliver called The Summer Day. It is easy to find on any kind of internet search you would care to make. I'm going to introduce you to a couple singers, one right now. Nina Simone is most famous for a song called Sinner Man. I had thought to play that entire song Sunday on the radio show, but it's 10.5 minutes long. It's a good song, but we have commercials and things here that we have to get in. You can't just be like Howard Stern and just go on and on and on and on and on and trust that the commercials will get played. This is a Nina Simone song. Look her up if you don't know her. This is someone who is, to my mind, sadly vanished from a lot of contemporary artists sample her tunes, but the contemporary music listening public doesn't know a great deal about her. She was a social activist among many things and an unbelievably cool person and an unbelievably talented singer. This should make you feel pretty good. Again, these are the Kogan stepping stones to 2016. This is Nina Simone. The song is called Feeling Good.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the
tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. Scent of the pine, you know how I feel. The freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me.
It's a pretty good song, don't you think? Feeling good. It's a very upbeat kind of song. Again, the singer is Nina Simone. I will spell it for you if you want to look it up on one of your various devices that will allow you to get on the internet. That's N-I-N-A. That would be Nina. And Simone would be S-I-M-O-N-E. And if you do start to sample her tunes, again, Sinner Man being without any argument, her most famous song. That buzzing and beeping you hear behind me is my cell phone, because I don't know how to turn off a cell phone. That's going to be one of my... I don't make resolutions. I think resolutions are stupid, and they are doomed almost in every case to fail. Just decide in July to do something, and it'll be a lot easier. You won't feel like a failure. But one of my resolutions is to learn how to use my cell phone correctly. Let's take a little break, and I'll play a couple more songs. Welcome back. This will be the last 13 minutes of Rick Cogan you will hear in the year 2015. I do appreciate not only listening today as I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy, but the Sunday night show, too. It's fun to do. It's quite fun to do, and I'm going to, because it worked as a sort of experiment the last 2 days. I'm going to start devoting more time to a lengthy, the hour-long interview instead of the, hey, what's your new book about, blah, 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 thanks a million, see you later, goodbye. Because I think we learned a lot about it. I never know where the interviews are going because I don't have 10 questions, and I thought Richard Lindbergh from 10 to 11 was really fascinating about contemporary Chicago, the history of gangs in Chicago, and about the relationship now between police and the people who live in Chicago. So I do this, I think, to engage and entertain and maybe inform you, but I also do it to learn a little something. Two remarkable singers, Maggie and Suzzy Roach, are called the Roach Sisters. And a few years ago, they came out with a spectacular, if you can get it. Again, you might want to write this down because I'm not sure everybody knows them. The CD was called Zero Church. Zero Church. It's not a technically religious album. It's a sort of folk album. And it's great. It's a terrific, terrific CD. And one of my favorites for years. One of the songs on there is a song called, I'm going to play it in a couple minutes, a song called Anyway. And the history of this song is just fascinating. It begins after it was written. I'll start telling you, I would go to various commencement addresses, to funerals, to all sorts of things for years, for maybe the last 10 years, and would hear people get up and they would read what they called a poem by Mother Teresa. And it was called Anyway. And I heard this a lot of times in a lot of different places. And then I heard it on the Roach Sisters album, Set to Music. You will hear it in a minute or two. Set to Music, and thought, this is unbelievably beautiful. So I did a lot of research about it at the time. And I discovered that a sheet of paper was found after the death of Mother Teresa at one of the many orphanages that she ran with saintly devotion. And so people assumed that it was something that she had written. It turns out that it was written in the 60s by a guy named Kent Keith. Kent Keith, who was a sophomore at Harvard University. And he wrote it for a kind of manual for student leaders. So it has, and you can now look all this up, since I've discovered this, it's all over the internet, the whole history of this song. But the sentiments of the song are something you should listen to. Again, it's another stepping stone into what I hope is a really, really nice, trouble-free year for you. Here are the Roach Sisters singing Anyway.
People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. Succeed anyway.
If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you.
Be honest and frank. Anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy. Overnight. Build anyway. Build anyway, yeah. And if you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will laugh and forget. Tomorrow, do good. It is between you and God. Yeah, yeah, you and God. It was never between you and them. Anyway, anyway, anyway.
There's no way for you to really tell me, but the question is, isn't that a lovely song? And it's a good, good meaning too. You can look it up so easily. You can look up the Roach Sisters, R-O-C-H-E. You can look up Mother Teresa. You can look up Kent Keith, the person who actually wrote that as a Harvard sophomore. It's a very empowering kind of poem. It's a roadmap for the next hour, the next week, the next year. I will close this year off for me. I'll be on Sunday. I think on Sunday I'm going to replay the interview we did with John Cusick yesterday, because I only have an hour show because of the Hawks games. I'll be on from 10 to 11. And John Kissick is the retired. He's retired as a priest, but he certainly still thinks like a priest. And he had some pretty amazing things to say about life and religion and this planet. So I think I may replay that. Here you go, ladies and gentlemen. This is an ancient sort of song. But listen carefully to the words and take them to heart as you prepare to enter, sober or drunk, the new year. Here's Danny Kaye singing One Life to Live.
There are many minds in circulation.
Yeah!
Believing in reincarnation.
Yeah!
In me you see one who doesn't agree. Challenging possible affronts.
Yes, yes.
I believe I'll only live once.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to make the most of it. If there's a party, I want to be the host of it. If there's a haunted house, I want to be the ghost of it. If I'm in town, I want to be the toast of it. I say to me every morning, you've only one life to live. So I be done in, let's let the sun in, and gloom can jump in the rear. No use to beat on the doldrum, let's be imaginative. Each day is numbered, no good when slumbered, with only one life to live. Why let the goblins upset you? One smile and see how they run. And what does worrying net you? Nothing, nothing is to have fun. All this may sound kind of hackneyed, but it's the best I can give. Soon comes December, so please remember, you've only one life to live. Just one life to live. I say to me every morning,
what do you hear from the mob door?
You've only one life to live.
You probably think it's over.
So why be down
it? For what?
Let's let the sun in,
what you got.
And gloom can jump in the river.
That's what we tell them down at the office.
No use to beat on the door.
That's what I think is from Dixie.
Let's be imaginative.
Devil may care as a pixie.
Each day is numbered.
What do you do with your day?
No good when slumber.
Dashing and fruiting away.
With only one life to live.
Why let the goblins upset you? One smile and see how they run. And what does worrying net you?
Oh, 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 nothing, nothing is to have fun.
Let's go!
All this may sound kind of
happy,
but it's the best I can give.
Don't let it beat you, Daddy.
Soon comes December, so please remember, you've only one life to live.
Just one life to live.